welcome to episode 282 of the Waterspeed FM podcast. I'm your host, Wei Shen, and I've got Tony with me here, finally, again. Hey, T, how's it going?
It's okay. Yeah, I'm pretty sure Theo will eventually have my job one day. So, you know, it's only right that he gets to replace me this quickly. So, but I'm back today.
Great. Well, I have a guest for us this week, but before we get to that, why don't you tell us a bit about NAFIS, which is happening next month?
Sure. If you're a subscriber, if you're not a subscriber, it doesn't matter. We have a conference coming up here in New York, the North American Financial Information Summit. I really do believe that it is the best gathering of, if you're talking about the, you know, the institutional wholesale capital markets, it's a great gathering, especially on the data end. Like, you know, if you're in the market data, reference data space, if you work in data at a bank, at an asset manager, at a vendor, or at an exchange, it's a great conference. And if you are an end user from bank, broker, asset manager, hedge fund, it's free to enter. If you're a vendor, you got to pay up. Or know somebody. You can beg me. We'll see. but it's going to be May 16th in Midtown Manhattan. And yeah, it's going to have two tracks. One's going to be more focused on data. One's going to be more focused on technology. If you're a reader of Waters Technology, that shouldn't come as a surprise. But yeah, we hope as many people show up and get there. Wei Shen will include a link to registering for it. I'm not going to do that, but yeah. So I think that's a good enough update. But it's definitely, we've got a lot of great speakers from a lot of different, from a swath of end users. So I think it's worth showing up to. Yeah, but... right now, everybody here is here to listen to your guest. Who is your guest today, Wei Shen?
Well, our guest this week is Joseph Low. He's the head of enterprise platforms at Broadridge. And he has almost two decades of experience in software engineering and product management in wealth and financial services. And interestingly enough, he was the one who led the product development team for BondGPT, Broadridge released in June last year. So let's get to it.
Get to it. Sounds good.
All right. Joining me this week is Joseph Low, head of enterprise platforms at Broadridge. Hi, Joseph. Welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Hi, Wei Shen. So good to be here and great to join you on the podcast.
Cool. I guess just before we begin, you know, could you give us an overview of yourself and your role at Broadridge?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm head of enterprise platforms at Broadridge. What that really means for a company like Broadridge, where we have a global presence in the fintech space, where we process over $10 trillion worth of trades every single day for our clients, my role is really to make sure that our company is looking at our technology as a platform across everything that we do. We want to make sure that our customers have an integrated experience where they can really get an experience that is consistent across all the products and services that we serve.
Cool. And how long have you been with the company?
Yeah, so it's a funny story. I've actually been with Broadridge for about 18 years now. I started as a software engineer and I've taken on lots of different roles throughout my tenure at Broadridge.
Wow. Okay. 18 years is it's almost two decades. Just give me an idea of how you actually started out in like software engineering and, you know, how you've kind of like progressed through that to be, you know, head of platform.
It's super interesting because one thing that's really been really good about Broadridge is that I think we have a really good program for how we develop our talent, and certainly I've been one of the beneficiaries of that. Started out as a software engineer at a startup that was acquired by Broadridge in Vancouver, and that startup makes, you know, cutting edge wealth management technology software. And really, I started really understanding the industry and the needs of financial advisors, wealth managers, from a software perspective. And I, as I got to learn more about the needs of financial advisors, wealth managers, I wanted to have a bigger role in determining what products we should do. So I moved into a product management role and, you know, really started to understand the needs of the users and how we can use my technology skills to apply that to the products we make. From there, took on roles that including professional services, but also leading innovation for our wealth management business. So it's been quite a journey for us, for me, and lots of fun.
Cool. So interestingly enough, I think, yeah, you led the product product development team for BondGPT and more recently OpsGPT, which Broadridge actually announced in January, right? Could you go into some of the details of, you know, what was involved, you know, how that idea actually came up, the decision to kind of use LLMs as a firm, you know, to provide that kind of service for your clients? And then, you know, what kind of like data sets that you needed to use to train the LLM? And yeah,
it's such a good question, because I think the advent of the democratization of AI, you know, over the last year has really changed a lot about how our customers expectations of companies like ours, you know. And so, and I think that's the big thing. And if you kind of take a step backwards, what's been happening over the past 2-3 years is actually even longer than that, is there's been a gradual change in expectations of financial services firms and for what they need from their vendors. I think that comes from really consumer technology, you know, consumers expecting more from the, you know, financial services firms. And so that those needs and expectations are actually carrying through. For us, we were really excited to be one of the very first financial technology companies to launch a production grade LLM application last year with BondGPT. But what's interesting is we didn't set out to create an AI chatbot. What actually happened was that our clients in the fixed income space, bond traders, portfolio managers, wealth managers, they were inundated with data, you know, both the volume of data, but the velocity of data that comes from that fixed income market. And there's just so many different sources. And what they were telling us is that it was difficult for them to consume all the information and make, you know, frequent analysis of what was happening in the marketplace. At the same time, at Broadridge, we had been investing in various AI models for a long time with our LTX division, creating patented AI models for liquidity discovery, but there wasn't a great way to merge all these things together. And so, you know, and so we'd been investigating various dashboards, BI tools, but everything wasn't enough, because there was always another view, another screen, another widget that needed to be made. And so when, and we'd been playing around with GPTs for a while now, but when GPT-4 came out, this was, I think, last February, February 2023, that's when everything changed, because some of the experiments, some of the models we were developing were now able to be properly elucidated by GPT-4. And so we quickly got to work, applied the latest models to the applications we were building. And what we were able to do was create a chatbot that could be as small as a little window on a bond trader's desk, or, you know, a full screen application where a bond trader could ask any question they want about the bond market, about what was happening in specific sectors, or even for specific bonds. Response has been really stunning, because it turned out that having a bond analyst in your pocket, you know, on your phone as a little window, makes a huge difference to a bond trader's workflow.
And I'm interested, like, so what have some of your clients actually said? I mean, those that have been using BondGPT, and I guess now that OpsGPT is also, you know, in the market, what have some of the feedback been? Like, have they perhaps saved some time, or have they been, is it more of like, okay, yes, it's an easier way to like look for information. I don't have to go to this screen and then move to the other screen or this other application.
You know, some of the things that we've heard from our clients is that things that used to take 30 minutes, an hour, is only now only taking 10, 20 seconds, right? So some of the examples that are questions that require complex calculations, aggregations, slicing and dicing of the data. Now you can just ask, generate a yield curve for a specific sector, with certain criteria, and it can do all those calculations and just in about 10, 20 seconds, generate that information. You mentioned OptGPT, and that's something that is pretty exciting as well. It's something that we launched to the market earlier this year, and we actually went live with our first client just last week. And so really excited about some of the initial feedback we've gotten for clients in production on that tool.
Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and what's exciting with that is, sometimes, and this is probably a good segue, when you think about these AI tools, the question sometimes is, okay, it's cool, but is it really changing everything? Is it really making things better? And so certainly with BondGPT, we saw that early on that, based on our clients' feedback, that they wanted better access to the data. Bond traders are great bond traders, but they're not necessarily data analysts. So being able to have an analyst in your pocket made a big difference. For the OpsGPT use case, it's a different value proposition. OpsGPT was built for operations professionals, analysts that spend most of their time doing tasks like settling trades or resolving trade breaks or reconciliation, and those things have a different type of profile. And so when we launched OpsGPT earlier this year, some of the things that we had trained our models or applications to do was really be able to synthesize lots of data from different screens, and be able to bring all the data in front of the operations analyst, but secondarily, suggest possible resolutions for the trade breaks, for example.
Okay, and because you are on the Waters Wavelength podcast, and here at Waters Technology, we like to go in deep into like how it is created and the kind of the data problems that you had to tackle to kind of like put these products out. So maybe tell me a little bit about how these two particular GPTs were trained, because obviously they're quite separate, right? And also they have different functionalities. One's for those in the bond trading bond market. The other one is more in operations, which can be everything, right?
Yeah.
In terms of asset classes.
Yes.
And a lot more processes and workflows involved there as well, as we know in the back office. So what was the main data problem you had to solve, and what data sets did you use to train BondGPT as well as OpsGPT?
Absolutely. I'd say that there's I'm glad that you asked the in-depth question, because in some ways, when you say, hey, we created some GPT, it's easy to kind of gloss over the details and just talk about, it's a chatbot. But really, the hard work starts with homogenizing the various data sources. If you think about how these large language models work, they work on tokens or essentially words, right? And so you have to really get to a place where you can harmonize and have a common data ontology for your data so that your models are transportable across different data domains. And so at Broadridge, we had been working on this for a while. It's an initiative that we call BRX, which is it's an ambitious initiative that we've been running for the past 5 years now, where we've been creating a common data model for all of Broadridge, and especially how Broadridge communicates with our clients and partners as well. So this BRX data ontology was the first step. We trained our models, our applications to all speak the same language. A good example of this is we want to make sure that, for example, if we're talking about an instrument or a security or a bond, that they have common identifiers. So whether it's a fixed income instrument, whether it's a equity and mutual fund that we want to be able to, we don't want the AI to have to be confused about how to reference those things. So by commonizing, making those common, it makes a huge difference. And so I'd say that that's the biggest thing. And that's allowed us to, you know, launch Bond GPT last year and quickly follow that up with Ops GPT as well. The second thing I'd say is that we've really platformized our AI capabilities at Broadridge. And so rather than looking at individual products, we've really taken some of the learning, some of the key AI programming to something that's repeatable across domains. And you may ask, so what are the key areas of AI that we focus on, right? So, So you know, first is we spend a lot of time with kind of the recognition side. You know, when a user asks something, that we spend time classifying the problem. So what is the user asking about? Is the user asking about a bond? Is it asking about a, you know, an equity, about a fund? And kind of using that to think about like a pinball machine, like putting making sure the questions go into the right place. And as we keep, and so the recognition, with that comes really our subject matter expertise and actually working with our clients and really going through and understanding the language associated with the user persona. So you know, data bank of what are the common terms, common phrases. For Bond GPT, we call that, we jokingly internally call it the Bond speak. So, you know, when people say, oh, what's the, you know, what are the, you know, bonds, you know, under the belly of the curve, you know, that means something to Bond people, but it means nothing to you and I. And so the certain terminology that we map to what the AI understands in our data model, right? And so that's the first step. The second step is what we call our retrieval agent, where we really spend a lot of time now bringing our data sources together. You might think that for an AI like this, part of what you might say is, hey, why don't we put all of our data into a big data warehouse so we can query it all? We had considered that upfront, but the reality is, or our vision for all this is that we wanted our agents and our GPTs to be able to not just access Broadridge data, but also external data like market pricing, company annual reports, for example, but even, you know, our clients' own data if they wanted to. And so we created a retrieval engine that knows how to, based on what the user asks, pull data from various sources, both within Broadridge and external to Broadridge. And what makes that powerful is that allows us to answer the user's question much more fully because we can combine sources. For bonds, a good example would be, so we may know, you know, so if they asked, for example, show me all the cruise bonds with a certain yield that traded at least 10 million last week. You know, what we'll do is we'll actually look at all the trace bond data, and we will actually see which bonds traded a certain, you know, volume, and we will collate that with the information we have within. So that's all done in a way that is transparent to the user. The third area that's something that we're pretty excited about is how we handle memory. You know, and if you think about how humans communicate, there's a certain amount of context. We have some short-term memory, we have some medium-term memory, we have some long-term memory, and whether, you know, when you talk to a friend, it's a combination of that. And we wanted, you know, our GPTs to have a similar feel where Bond GPT, for example, understands the context of the conversation, understands what you mean, you know, sometimes based on some of the previous things that have happened, right?
Does that mean that you can, so like a user can go to it and, I don't know, ask a question, but so let's say, for example, the GPT is actually retrieving everything that it has learned from your communication with it and, you know, give you an answer based on that. So like, yeah, it already knows that you have asked it this before, kind of like a friend, like you would know that your friend went to, let's say, a music festival recently, yeah, and then you kind of base questions off of that. Is that right?
Yeah, like, you know, like if I saw you, I might say, oh, How was that play you went to, you know? But maybe more like like if you had a data analyst on your team and they knew that you only traded in REITs or only in high yields, that you wouldn't have to say, hey, show me, you know, if I said, oh, give me a list of bonds that meet this criteria, I wouldn't have to say high yields or REITs because they know that that's your specialty, right?
I see.
Where that's become really interesting is we were talking to a wealth management firm where for their firm, you know, when they think of high yields, they think of it differently as what the ratings agencies are. They're more conservative. And so in that case, they wanted it, you know, they wanted it, and our memory made it work really well for that, where they said, hey, when I think of high yields, I think of triple B and higher. You know, then it said, okay, great. So now I know if you ask for a high yield, that means, you know, triple B or better. And so that's been interesting.
How does it save that memory? And
yeah, because it's kind of interesting, right? Because but I think that's like the power of AI and how that, like, the concept of being so personal, even for business software. And sometimes you expect that to be the case for your Netflix account, but you don't expect that to be the case for the stuff you use at work, right? And so what we actually do is we classify, you know, the questions that are that the user interacts the system with, and we tag the user with certain key themes, right? And I think that's the key. As well, we allow the user to specify custom instructions, so they can actually say, for example, yeah, I only trade these things, or, you know, I only care about Japanese bonds or whatever, and it will know how to respect that without requiring, you know, someone to do something in the settings or require someone to do any filters. It kind of does that on its own.
Okay.
One last thing to say though. I think this is probably the most important thing is, and when you think about Gen AI, a lot of times people are concerned about hallucination and concern about what people, concern that it may say things that you don't want the firm to say. And so in order for us to really get these products out to market, we also developed a compliance engine that monitors everything that the AI says. And we actually actively review it against a compliance rule book using Gen AI still, and we will rewrite anything that either comes into the AI or leaves the AI that the compliance agent thinks is not suitable to go to the user.
Okay, interesting. So and you mentioned three key, I guess four now. So like the first was recognition, and then obviously
retrieval,
and then memory, and lastly, well, I guess compliance. Overall compliance, right?
Yeah.
I'm just curious. So like for firms that are also, you know, building their own GPTs or experimenting with large language models and generative AI, you know, where do you think, and kind of like referencing back these four key things that you mentioned earlier, where do you think the biggest challenge is for them, and how should, is there a right or wrong way to kind of like mitigate some of those challenges?
Some of the things when we talk to clients, some of the areas that we see people, you know, make some wrong turns is when you focus too much on the model and not enough on the user experience.
What is an example of that?
For example, early on, I think last year there was a lot of excitement when, for example, Bloomberg released their own Bloomberg GPT model, and it's like, oh, it's trained on all their data and it must be really good. And turns out GPT-4, which is commercially available and costs $30 for a million tokens, it outperforms that. Even though GPT-4 has more information. And I guess specifically, as it's always been about the user experience. Like, so, you know, sometimes people will say, okay, you know, a new model comes out, let's quickly fine tune it, let's train it, let's do all these things. And the reality, especially in the business world, sometimes it's not about the most capable model. It's about the model that has the most, is the model that works best for the user's experience. Even sometimes at Broadridge, we sometimes, there's always a push and pull. It's like, you know, you hear about a new model that came out. It's like, oh yeah, let's try it. But, you know, every step you kind of do to try some new model, do something actually maybe distracts you from building out the product that the users, that your users really need. And so I think that's one thing. Second thing I would really kind of lean in on is that a fast and ready access to your data is really important. You know, you can't be successful if you can't get at the data that you need the models to hydrate the models. Both from a fine tuning or training perspective, if you're doing fine tuning or training, but even for, you know, in our cases, a lot of the work that we're doing is called retrieval augmented generation, where we're pulling the data from our various data sources at the time of generation. Well, you need that data to be available, but you also need that data to be properly indexed, cataloged, permissioned, you know, and with a clear lineage of who's allowed to see it, use it, all the way from, you know, where the data is stored all the way to the user. And so that'd be something that I know that if you don't get those things right, you're going to be in for a lot of hurt.
So it all comes back to the data, really. So I know Broadridge has BRX and that data ontology. Would you say that actually having that actually really helped? If there were no data ontology at your firm, you know, how much work would it have taken to actually get these like two products up and running?
Yeah. I would answer it in two. I'd answer it in two parts. Not having a consistent data model, you can kind of fake it till you make it for like a little while. But where things go wrong is as you keep adding more things, then it catches up to you. The tech debt catches up to you. You know, for our OpsGPT, I'll use an example, is OpsGPT is sort of an AI layer that sits on top of the various processing engines that we have. You know, for example, we have, you know, market leading security equities processing, fixed income processing, and you have all these different things. And they, you know, behind the scenes, they are, some of them are different systems, right? And so we launched, and so what we were able to do was to launch OpsGPT that knows how to talk to a few of those underlying systems all at the same time, because we had already harmonized that. So it's a multiplication game. If you didn't have the ontology already there, you would have to do the same thing. You'd have to do all the data mapping to the AI all the time, you know, per system. We know the hardest part of any project is the integration. And so for us, by doing that ahead of time, again, over the last 5 years, it's been a big focus of ours. I think that's allowed us to, you know, kind of get to market, but it'll also allow us to add more value to our OpsGPT users as we bring more of those systems online.
So I was actually going to ask you next about, like, you know, as firms like go through and try to upgrade or overhaul, I guess, their legacy platforms, and trying to use, let's say, emerging technologies to either put that in place of their legacy platforms or to augment their legacy platforms. I mean, but if they don't have the data in the right place, mapped and accurate and all of that, you know, is there even a point?
Well, you know what? I think that AI has so many different applications that the smart technologists will find the problems that are solvable in the, you know, you'd bracket it around horizons. You'd say, what are the problems that we can solve today? With, you know, what are the problems that we need to solve, you know, next, and what are the problems we'll solve later, right? A good point, you know, like sometimes when you talk to people that are in transformation, there's always this discussion of, hey, do we want to just put lipstick on a pig? You know, do we just want to automate a manual process? Let's put some OCR and some bots in place. And it doesn't really fix the problem. But what I would advise people that haven't really gotten their data house in order is, yeah, you have to do that. But there are many use cases with generative AI that you'll find incremental benefit, maybe not transformative benefit, but incremental benefit for various parts of the business. Some examples are what we've deployed at Broadridge internally for our associates. So we have about 15,000 employees across the globe, and we need our associates to be more productive too. We need our associates to be more to be able to serve our clients better too. And so last year we launched an internal chat assist called BroadGPT, which is like a ChatGPT, runs GPT-4, it runs, you know, Llama, various models where users can log on and just use it to, for example, generate an email for a client, or, you know, or to reword or summarize a meeting, generate an executive summary. And that really helps firms in the bottom line too, if you think about it. So it's not necessarily, hey, let's bring all of our data together, let's put chat on top, because that stuff is, that can be very transformative. But if you think about, if you can help an employee save 30 minutes of their day, where they're not, you know, writing a, you know, meeting minutes to send to their boss or something, or if a salesperson taking a sales call and they can summarize that into something they can put into Salesforce, that's going to accelerate the velocity of our sales team. It's going to accelerate the velocity of our development teams and all that stuff. And so we're really, so that's something that a lot of people can jump on, because it's not just about all the data in your systems. It's actually about the data in your head, you know, and, you know, it's GPTs are pretty good at, you know, in their pre-trained model state, they know a lot about the data around the world. Right. And so that's been something really good for us.
Interesting. So then in that case, it is kind of like possible to run the bank and change the bank, right?
That's a good way to think about it, because that's a really good way to think about it, is that there's a lot of ways to run the bank better with Gen AI. You know, I think, yes, you have to get comfortable, work with vendors that have security policies, data processing agreements, you know, that you're comfortable with, and all those good things, and, you know, and have proper compliance and, you know, measures and data leakage measures and all those good things. But at the heart of it, what we're seeing is that, you know, on a weekly basis, our employees are, you know, summarizing hundreds of hours of meetings a week, you know, using the AI, being able to distribute. And then that, what that does is that increases the clock speed of our company, allows us to go from, I don't know, 133 megahertz to 166 megahertz. You know, we can run faster because if the information flows faster from employee to employee.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think this discussion has been very interesting, and I think it will, it'll be something, you know, to kind of get you back on at a later stage to kind of give us an update for sure. But just before we end here, so I understand that you are a DJ and also part of a family band. Could you tell me a little bit about that and I guess your hobbies?
Yeah, that's, you know, it's super fun because I have three kids. They're not little anymore. They're a bit older now. But one of the things that we love doing for New Year's Eve is we'll have all the kids from school over for a big party at our home, and also I'll break out my DJ equipment, specialties like EDM music, and been trying to do some beat matching. But what's fun is when I go to the kids' school, they always say, "Oh, there's DJ Joe." I'm like, "Yeah, that's me. I'm DJ Joe." and the whole, you know, and I always grew up playing music, and so kind of passed that joy to my kids. And so, you know, my daughter plays the bass guitar, my older son plays the drums, and so we love when they were younger, we'd go to farmers markets, we'd go to, you know, public places, and we would, you know, play music, you know, our favorites, 80s rock, like Bon Jovi. And so, and as a play on words on my last name, we called ourselves Lo and Behold.
That's nice. Because yeah, you don't know this about me because I haven't told you yet, but I'm a huge EDM fan as well. So I'd be interested to know who's your favorite EDM DJ.
You know, I used to be more. I used to have more varied tastes, but, you know, my daughter loves the Chainsmokers, and so that's playing in my house all the time. And you know, what we like to do is watch the Tomorrowland concerts on YouTube, and we have a lot of fun with that.
That's cool.
Yeah.
My favorite is Armin van Buuren.
Yes.
He's the king. yeah. Great. Well, it was very fun talking to you. I really enjoyed this conversation and hope you did it too. But yeah, we'll get you on at another time to talk more.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.